So as we go through, is that my first one? Yeah, okay. As we go through the Bible, God's plan of salvation, we are up to exile, which is where we find the book of Esther. If you have a Bible, please do open to 501. Easy to remember, Levi's. Different Bibles, though, isn't it? Page 501. If you haven't got a Bible, there's plenty. Please do get one. And we're going to skim through Esther this evening. It's going to be a bit of a flyover and a bit rushed. And it's certainly not going to answer every thought or question you have. But it's going to be a bit of a flyover with some thoughts. There will be opportunities to read as well. So if you want to, when the chance comes, you can come and read a section of Esther. That's the plan. So Esther is set in Susa, which is deep into the Persian Empire, beyond Babylon, and Israel has been taken captivity. It's this part of the Bible. But what's unique about Esther? There's a kind of fact everyone knows, isn't there? Oh, sorry. A lot of people know. No mention of God. Yeah, so God's name is not mentioned in Esther. Interesting, isn't it? He's off stage, if you like, although very much on stage, as we'll see in many ways. It's the last of the history books, Esther is. What might we say Esther's about? Anyone want to have a call it out? Yeah, rescue of God's people, the Jews, yeah. Anything to add to that? Any other thoughts? Just throw some things out. Okay, yeah. Yeah, thank you. Man's thoughts aren't God's thoughts, Joseph. Yeah. The unseen God working his purpose out. Those sort of things. It's a very interesting book, and some of you love the book of Esther, and I kind of wish we had more than one on Esther, but we'll preach it one day. There's a number of themes that are really interesting. You've got Israel, God's people dispersed in Persia, so they're a religious minority, and they're surrounded and dominated by this culture, aren't they, with different views. How do they relate? How would we relate if that was us? It is us, really, isn't it? You've got freedom in this country, it's different, but do they withdraw? Do they try and fit in? Do they keep their views quiet? Do they protest? What should you do in this kind of environment? Esther helps us, this book does, think how we kind of follow God in morally crazy situations as well, which again, we're thankful. I mean, we do have moral craziness in our country, but there's also freedom as well. Does God work with you as well? How does he work with us in difficult times? Those sorts of things. We also see in the book of Esther, in this male-dominated society, culture, where a woman becomes a vehicle for social justice. That is really, really striking, particularly in the culture then. It plays out as a real drama. So we're going to take it in scenes, starting with Act 1, Woman Trouble, Chapter 1. Now, the king is the main focus, if you look at Chapter 1. And he is not PC. I mean, he really is not, which is okay, because we're going back to Susa approximately sort of 480 years before Christ. Would someone like to come and read the striking Chapter 1, verses 1 to 8 to us? Who'd like to come and read 1 to 8? Trevor, let me shift. Okay, yeah, do it from there. Okay.
This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink without restriction, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Sounds like a good party.
Thank you, Gemma. Big party, yeah, long party. I mean, Xerxes, so this is the one who didn't defeat the Greeks, isn't it? Had a few problems. 300 is a film I'm sure none of you have watched, but it's that lot. Xerxes, I mean, it's a massive empire. It's huge. It really is. And these verses, which is why we read this bit, just highlight he's king. Like, he really is king. He's in control. That's what we're meant to see. And we're meant to be wide-eyed and gaze and wonder what some of these precious things are and just be in awe at the opulence, the flags, the buildings. You know, he's got Air Force One, you know, there, isn't he? He's got all the cars lined up, all the camels, and it's 180 days he's displaying. How long would it take us to display our wealth and things? 8 minutes? I don't know. 8 seconds? 180 days. Incredible. And it's an open bar, isn't it? I think that's what you're referring to. Oh, no, it's in verse 8. Loves that open bar. Okay, open bar, and it led to the high spirits of verse 10. So we're not going to read it all, so you're going to need to skim down as well. So the king, verse 10, had one too many. Hardly surprising. And in his drunken state, the story goes on. He says, guys, what a great idea if we get my wife in and have a look at her. Okay. And there's these thousands of drunken men to have a look at his wife. She's really gorgeous. Let's get her in and have a look at her. What do you reckon, guys? You can imagine the rugby club, you know, woo-hoo, cheering along, that sort of thing. Look at verse 12. She is not doing it. Good for her. She is not doing it. Naughty wife, you might think. Wise wife. Incredibly brave wife. Absolutely. Unbelievably brave. In a culture where her job was to uphold the social norms, she refuses. I'm not doing that. I mean, she could have cost her life. It really could. By the way, Esther, this book, as we're going to see, is full of reversals. And it's full of irony as well. And the first thing, the ironic thing is, this unbelievably powerful king, he's the most powerful in the world at the time. It's amazingly powerful, but he cannot control his wife. No comments. And the king is embarrassed. He's irate. He's fuming, isn't he? So verse 13, if you look, the party dies. He calls a cabinet meeting. It's his wise men, and it's those who understand the times, and his lawyers, and they're straight into the Oval Office. And verse 16, Memucan, what great name, he sees, here is one who understands the time, he sees a feminist movement boinging out of this, okay? And he says, verse 17, we need to be careful here. The queen's conduct will spread to all women. It will spread throughout the empire. It must be stopped. You know, if this gets in Hello Magazine and all the rest of it, there's going to be no end of trouble for husbands everywhere. So verse 19, let's make a law. They love their laws. There are lots of laws in this book. Let's banish the queen. She got off quite lightly, really, in the times. I don't think she did. Anyway, let's not go into that. But, and then it's such overkill in this law, that in the whole empire, all women must respect their husbands. I mean, how to get them talking about it, really, is the opposite. You know, he's got everyone talking about it. Oh, why is this law? What happened? You know, and so on. And then all these men pat each other on the back. But the writer is mocking, really, isn't he? Because the king has this huge kingdom, but his power is a visage, really. He looks like God, but he's not. He really is not. Chapter 2, verse 1. Again, we're reading bits, and we're going to not read bits as well. But you can see later, King Xerxes' fury subsided. So once he'd calmed down and sobered up, the search begins for a new queen. So a beauty pageant is held. And this is morally disgraceful. It really is. Taking all these young ladies, not by choice, they've taken many young women in the land. Some thinking up to 1,000 young ladies were taken into his harem. And for one whole year, they had to undergo beauty treatments. And so you might think, oh, I like the sound of that. No, I don't think so. Or maybe for a whole year. But it's really bad because it meant that was them done. They had a whole year of beauty treatments for their one night with the king. And that one meeting with the king was huge. It meant a lot. If he didn't like them, then they wouldn't go home. They weren't allowed to go back home. They couldn't ever get married to someone else. That's absolutely awful, isn't it? They would be concubines, permanent concubines in his harem. And if he did like them, they would be a concubine. And there's words to explain later here, aren't there? I'm so sorry. It's tricky. I'll leave that to you, parents. Sorry. sorry. And me, parents. Sorry. And they would be concubines who would be called by the king now and then. Or if they were really lucky, if you could say, then three or four of them he would marry. And they would have children by him, that was the plan, who would be his heirs. Or if you're really favoured, you would be the one, and you would be queen. It's just a madness to live in a culture like this, isn't it? Can you imagine it? Maybe 1,000 young women brought into this situation. But look at 2 verse 5. You see this in the Bible, you want to sit up a bit straighter, don't you? Now there was a Jew. Now there was a Jew. And Mordecai is an exile from Jerusalem, and he had a cousin who he'd raised as his daughter. Okay, so her name there you can see is Hadassah. Oh, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it. Also known as Esther. Well, that's better, isn't it? Esther, and it reads that she was lovely in figure. She was beautiful. And so she is included. So she has all the cosmetics, she has this year and so on, but she remains silent about being a Jew. Verse 15, chapter 2, it's her turn to see the king, and she wins his favour more than any other. So verse 17, he makes her queen, celebrates the banquet and a holiday. And again, just amazing, isn't it? This little orphan Jewish girl becomes queen to the greatest empire in the world. Again, throughout Esther, there's this portrait of invisibility. Almost remember the story of Moses. So Moses snuck into the king's household under his very nose. And it's similar, isn't it? God is not mentioned by name in Esther at all. It comes fairly close. When there's a call to pray and so on, as we'll see. And you think, well, why is God's name not mentioned? Is it an oversight? Did they just forget? Well, apparently, and I agree with this, it's kind of a deliberate thing by the writer, because the Jews then were in great danger, powerful forces trying to kill them. But God is in Esther, absolutely. There's a whole string of coincidences that take place, showing God maneuvering his plans and purposes, showing behind the visible is an invisible God. So the king gets drunk, and he needed to get drunk so the Vashti queen incident could happen. Esther's pretty and gets in the pageant thing. And we're going to hear as well, Mordecai just happens to be in a place to hear. And the king, as we're going to see, can't sleep one night. And these things that are built by the baddie coming up and so on, just one thing after another, that you just think, God is at work. Absolutely is at work, making these, what look like coincidences, happen. And he's keeping his promises, isn't he? Even when it seems that God is nowhere around. And that is really helpful for us to remember. And it's really one of the really helpful things that Esther teaches us. In our lives, don't take God's silence as absence. That's not the case. He is never absent. His hiddenness is not abandonment as well. So we should remember that when the difficult times come, when we feel that way. Esther as well, herself, I mean, just seems irrelevant. She's just another wife, another girl, but the irony is that she is a significant player in this drama. And she's the weak one, isn't she? She's an outsider. She's got no choice in things. She's bossed around by this pagan king who thinks he's in control. But even behind his bad behavior is God, isn't he? Which also helps us to think about worldly powers, like the book of Daniel, isn't it? How do we view earthly powers today? How do we view kings, presidents today who are out of control, who are evil and make bad and wicked decisions? This book helps us in these things. Okay, let's come to scene two. The King's Good Books. So this is a small little reading coming up, but a really important section, as we'll see. So is there someone who'd like to read chapter 2, verse 19 to 23? Chapter 2, verse 19 to 23. Don't worry about the difficult names. A lot of people struggle with those, don't they? They're brave to have a go. Yes, and she's on her way. Oof. All right, 19 to 20.
When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions, as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana?
Yeah, sounds good.
And Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king.
Thank you very much. Great, thank you. So there's Mordecai, and he's hanging around the king's gate. That wasn't a strange thing to do. Stuff happened there. That was kind of the place to be, really. And it certainly did, because Mordecai happens to hear Big Boy and Terry Toughnut, two baddies, complaining and plotting against the king. There's no health package in this job. You know, we're, you know, minimum wage, extra hours, all these things we've got to do that's extra. I can't stand it anymore. What should we do? Anyway, there's a problem. They're coming up with a plan. Mordecai hears, and he's loyal to the king's authority. It's interesting, isn't it? Here's a Jew. Yeah, a bit like Daniel. Lord to the king's authority, he sends a message. These two are investigated. They're found guilty and they're killed. And the incident is recorded in the king's diary. Small, but very important. Let's go to scene three and evil plans. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 2. After these events, King Artaxerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honour to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honour. So, what just happened in the reading before, Mordecai revealing this plot and so on, well, it goes unrewarded, doesn't it? Mordecai doesn't get rewarded for that. Instead, look, the wrong person gets to the top, doesn't he? Haman, the Agagites. Now, Agag was king of the Amalekites. You can read back, it's in 1 Samuel. This is one of the ancient enemies of God's people, the Amalekites. Many problems in the Old Testament and instructions concerning them. He is one of those people. Mordecai, this is going further in the passage, knows who Haman is. Mordecai will not kneel. He will not bow to him. Again, interesting, in a foreign land. Haman's getting mad about the situation. He knows who Mordecai is and who his people are, the Jews. So there's these bad vibes between Haman and Mordecai. And we just watched this on VeggieTales this afternoon, and I'm struggling to keep certain pictures out of my head. If you've watched VeggieTales, Esther, one or two. It's very funny. I recommend it. It's on YouTube as well. So they really don't like each other, but Haman plots how to deal with Mordecai, but plans also, verse 6, to destroy all of Mordecai's people. Mordecai is doing a Daniel, really, isn't he? He's refusing to bow in a foreign land, and great heat is coming on him. And Haman's plot is terrible, isn't it? It is absolutely awful. And he takes it in verse 8 to the king. And he tells the truth to the king, in one sense. He said the Jews have their own customs. And then he lies to the king as well. He says, but it's not in your interests to keep them. Mordecai just saved the king's life. So he's wrong about that, isn't he? And he asks for a decree to destroy all the Jews. And he pays, and he's willing to pay 10,000 for this to happen. It's just outrageous, isn't it? Outrageous. And almost as bad is this weak, stupid, kind of drunken oath of a king who doesn't seem to ask. He doesn't seem to sort of ask any questions about this. He doesn't even want the money. He kind of stamps, okay, and it's made, it's done. That is awful. A date is set, dispatches are sent to the empire, and verse 13 is very chilling. I'll read it in a moment. There seems to be no future for God's people. It looks as though the Jews are about to be wiped off the map. So verse 13 of chapter 3, dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. Three words. I stack them up like that. Young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 13th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as a law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so they'd be ready for that day. I mean, that is awful, isn't it? Scene 4. No, not scene 4. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's just think for a moment about the extremity of this hatred. I mean, it is unbelievable, isn't it? That this one sort of problem he has with Mordecai leads to this. But of course we know there's something deeper going on, don't we? It reminds us we live in a world where there is an irrational hatred towards God's people. And some of us may have a very positive view on the future of Christianity on this planet. Great. But the picture for many in many countries today in the world is that the enemy is close by and closing in. That's the reality for so many Christians today. There are pockets of Christians and there are countries where there's liberty and so on, and we're one of them. But, you know, conversions are low. For many around the world, they're waiting for this kind of edict, really. You just need to think. Imagine you're a Christian somewhere in the world, Sudan, Eritrea, various places, just waiting for this edict, because hostility is real, and the future for a Christian today in many parts is really dangerous and bleak, isn't it? Which reminds us, as we'll come to at the end, of a day when God's representative was opposed by all the important people, wasn't he? Plots were made, weak kings washed their hands of him, and it looked like God's people would be wiped off the map that day. But we'll come back to that. Let's go to scene four, for such a time. Chapter four, verses 1-14. Would somebody like to come and read? I'll read the short ones because it's worth your while coming up for a couple of verses. But this is 14 verses. Would someone like to come and read? Joe, thank you very much.
When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth, bear with me, was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city, in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain to her, and he told him to instruct her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death, unless the king extends the golden scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days had passed since I was called to go to the king." When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance from the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but you have come to your royal position for such a time as this."
Thanks very much. So the grief and anguish is so strong, isn't it, at the beginning of that reading. And of course, Mordecai must see Esther. His past, though, doesn't get him close enough, does he? So the message gets through and a plan is needed, and the plan is to plead with the king for mercy. But it's not that simple, as we heard read. To see the king is invitation only, or it's death. I mean, again, it's crazy, but that was the rule. So she has this dilemma that is really scary, isn't it? Mordecai encourages her with the truth that just because she is the queen, it won't mean she'll escape the edict. So it's a bit personal kind of repeat on her if you like. But then verse 14 is the famous line, and he's full of faith, saying, if you don't, you know, basically God will find another way to deliver, but perhaps this is why you're placed where you are for this moment. Maybe that's what's going on here, Esther. The plan developing needs prayer and fasting and courage. Verse 16, didn't read this bit, but she says, I will break the law. I will go and see the king. And she says, if I die, I die. I perish, I perish. And how many times have we heard Christians quote verse 14 for such a time? And it's a fair one as well, isn't it? Because we do. And we are placed at times, and we can relate sometimes, not exactly, fortunately, but for being in the right place in that right moment, the way God works things. And of course, Jesus was perfectly so, wasn't he? He came at just the right time, Paul says in Romans. The question for Jesus, will Jesus obey? Will he take the plunge? Will he do it? Esther's obedience, in one sense, prefigures his. More on that. Chapter 5, more on that in a bit. Chapter 5, Esther takes courage and takes the plunge. The king is on his throne. She puts on her royal robes in chapter 5 there. And there's huge tension. She walks into the place she is not allowed to be. And he sees her, and it's the moment that could break, make it all. And it's huge relief, isn't it? All is okay. Ah, it's Esther. It's my queen. I remember her. It's been a month, but I remember her. And verse 3 of chapter 5 is typically just over the top. What do you want? Even half my kingdom. He thinks he's in a fairy tale, doesn't he? But the request is a meal invitation. A feast. I'd like to invite you for a feast. You and Haman. And she's smart. And she is there for the right time. She's inviting him to where she's going to be. She's going to prepare some food. And that was a big thing. To invite someone for a meal which you prepared. It said a lot. So she was seeking by this to establish the relationship with the king that she has. And not to mention that we all know the way to a man's heart, don't we? Through his stomach, is the phrase. So they have a nice dinner. And Esther's request is that they do it again. And Haman goes home, and he's happy until... let's look at chapter 5, verse 9. Would somebody like to read chapter 5, verse 9 to 14 to us? Oh, thank you, Luke. All right, chapter 5, verse 9. Thank you.
Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him, and how he elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all. Haman added, I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. His wife, Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Have a pole set up reaching to a height of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself." This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up.
Thank you very much, Luke, for reading that to us. So there's Haman coming out of this first banquet. He's nice and full. He walks past his limo. All is well in his world. And then, bang, down to earth he comes. He sees Mordecai, and all is not right. He's reminded, isn't he? And it sends him into this rage and into this big boast which Luke read to us about all his staff, his position, I've been invited, and so on. He must have been a nightmare friend to have, mustn't he? And his wife and his friends suggest he builds a big gallows. So he goes into his workshop and he builds some version. So it is a bit nasty, this stuff in here. It's pretty brutal, isn't it? Some versions might say gallows, some say poles. Not quite sure. The original in Hebrew is a tree. And basically it was set up high. It was the Persian version of crucifixion. A cursed death. The worst, I mean, in every way. And Haman is a proud man. And what happens to the proud? The pride? Pride comes before a fall. He's in great danger, isn't he, as we know. He's in massive danger. So let's come to Act 5, the king's sleepless night. Chapter 6. The king couldn't sleep. And by pure chance, some might say, in the absence of late night films, he decides to read his diary and have it read to him. And by pure chance, some might say, the bit is read to him about the time where Mordecai uncovered this plot which saved him. And he's like, oh, I remember that. Yeah, he was a good guy. He did that for me, didn't he? What did I do for him? Nothing. Oh, I better do something. I mean, he's a king. He's got some time on his hands probably as well. Let's do something good for this guy. And from verse 4, it's early in the morning, and again, it's just so much irony here. Who's around in the palace who can help me do something for Mordecai? And Haman had just walked in. And Haman had come asking for permission to kill Mordecai. Haman has got up early. Haman's got the early train. Haman's off to work with a spring in his step. Because he has come full of positivity. He thinks everything's going his way and he's going to get stuff done. And it really is dripping with irony, this section. Verse 6, Haman, what would you do for the man who the king delights to honour? And you can imagine Haman thinking, okay, yeah, let's play this little game. It's me, he's talking about me, it must be me. So Haman comes up with this great reward. Well, if I were you, your majesty, I'd give the person the royal robe and the royal crest, and I parade them through the streets. And everyone shout and watch and so on. It's almost treason, isn't it? The royal robes and so on. And yes, says the king, that's a great reward. I'll do it. And then the bomb drops on Haman's head. Good, now do that for Mordecai. And in the rest of that chapter, he does, parades Mordecai through the streets. And Haman goes home distressed, more angry than ever. I'm ruined. And he's just irate. But there's no time. Can you see the end of chapter 6? There's no time to do anything because it's time for the second banquet. So verse 14, while they're still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. So let's go to Act number 6, Dinner with Esther, part 2 it is. And chapter 7, again, time's ticking, so I'm going to just whiz through this. It's the second feast. The question comes to Esther again from the king. What is it you desire? Why have you called this? And there's three elements to what she says next. First, she says, if I have your favor. So the point is, you chose me. I do have your favor, don't I? And you chose me, so your reputation is bound up in what happens to me as well. So it's quite a loaded thing to say, isn't it? If I have your favor, and then comes the petition, save me. But have your favor, save my life, because I'm about to die. And could you imagine being the king? This is a huge shock, isn't it? An assault on the queen is an assault on the king, really. And he said, what? Why? What's happening? And here comes the explanation. My people and I are about to die. We've been sold to be destroyed. And I, me too as well. Who has done this? Where is he? And can you imagine Haman sitting there? What a terrible moment for him. This vile, spit it out, Haman. And the king is in a rage. And the king needs to think. So he goes out to the garden because he has a problem here, doesn't he? He didn't think out the ramifications of the decree which he just stamped. Again, think Daniel and the lion's den. It's really similar stuff, isn't it? Like most ancient kings, though, he's not mad at himself. He's got to take it out on someone else, which works out very well, doesn't it? He's mad at Haman. And Haman knows it, which is why Haman, sorry we're not reading it, big read book of the month, please read Esther. Haman does what he does next, which is to get down and beg the queen on her couch. And this is like the final nail in the coffin. This is outrageous behavior, because the law then was that no male was allowed to be in the same room as the king's harem. Okay, unless there were eunuchs that designated. When the king left and went out to the garden, Haman should have got out of there quick. But Haman, of course, is in meltdown mode, isn't he? He's losing judgment. His life is flashing before his eyes. So instead of leaving, he throws himself toward the queen, begging. And it's way too close. But as the king comes back in, and now the decision's even easier, isn't it? My clothes, my royal robe, he suggested, my horse, now my wife. And we see how hated Haman is, because the servants pipe up as well. In verse 9, there's are some gallows already been built, actually, my lord, at Haman's house. Perfect, says the king. Take him away. And that's the end of Haman. But it's not the end of the story. And at a reasonable pace, let's wrap this up. Act 7, resolution and rest. So chapter 8 we're up to. It ends up that Mordecai has Haman's estate. So there's that reversal thing again. And Esther, again, sorry we're not reading it, proposes a counter decree. So you can't change the first one, laws of Medes and Persians and so on, but a law is added. And the law is that if anyone attacks the Jews can fight back. They can defend themselves. And they can take their attackers' stuff as their own plunder. And Esther hopes, because of this, when this day comes that's still planned, no one will attack the Jews. Because this next edict goes out. Jews, you can defend yourselves. But many did try to. And there is a lot of bloodshed as a result. But you can see in 9 verse 10 at the end, they didn't take the attacker's stuff as plunder. They did not lay their hands on the plunder. And that is to show they're being trying to be clear. This is self-defense. We're not, you know, being greedy and so on. And 9 verse 22 is a quite a key verse. It reads, the Jews got relief or rest in the original from their enemies. So let's just end with this big Bible word. Because the great promise and the great goal of salvation is rest. Rest is a huge word in the Bible, a huge thing for Christians. Israel was promised rest, weren't they? But it never seemed to last, did it? There were slaves in Egypt. They were attacked en route to the lands. They were attacked in the lands. They went to exile, then the Romans in the New Testament. I mean, how much rest did Israel actually experience? They did obviously get some rest. There was rest under Moses for a while, under Joshua, under some of the judges for a while. Under David, there was a time of rest. Under Solomon, under Esther here. All these kind of Messiah figures prefigure the Messiah. They bring rest, but they don't bring rest for long. So let's just think about this wonderful rest, because the prophets come along, don't they, before the New Testament, and they say the Messiah's coming, and he is going to bring true rest and peace from the enemies. And then we go, well, here we are today. And there are many believers, and they are not at rest. It's very, very difficult. So how does Jesus bring rest? The disciples thought it was going to be physical, didn't they? So they said, right, Jesus, what should we do about this lot that ignored you? Let's send a fire from heaven on them. That's what we do to our enemies. That sort of thing. Or let's get our swords ready. But Jesus then says things like, when you love your enemies, forgive those and keep forgiving them. And let them slap you on the other cheek as well. And right at the end, when the enemy comes to grab Jesus in the garden and the swords come out and an ear comes off, Jesus says, put it away. And he goes and he dies on the cross. How does Jesus bring rest? The answer is because the cross is the ultimate warfare on evil, which brings the ultimate rest. Galatians reads, Jesus became a curse for us, because cursed are all who are hung on a tree. And what Jesus did was not come into this world to destroy this enemy or that enemy, but to destroy enmity. Not the enemy, but enmity, didn't he? Ephesians tells us Jesus on the cross destroyed enmity between Jew and Gentile. If Jesus had come and beaten the Romans, you know, physically, he would have destroyed one enemy of Israel. But he came to do something far greater, far bigger, didn't he? He came to destroy sin and death itself. And that is the ultimate warfare. Because if we wrong each other, and this is painful to think about, but when someone wrongs you and hurts you, we think, our world thinks, it's doing something back to them, isn't it? It's kind of okay. We can slander them. We can, you know, do something. We can give them the silent treatment. You know, anything that's going to hurt their happiness in some way because of what they've done to me. That's our default mode, isn't it? To get back at our enemies to such an extent that we get rest. Let's do stuff to them so that we get rest. But in that, we might get the enemy, okay, for that time, but we will not defeat enmity, will we? And actually, it makes everything worse, doesn't it, when that happens? It really does. When we fight evil with evil, evil wins, doesn't it? It makes us colder, it makes us harder, it makes us prouder, it makes the enemy more angry. And if you've got an enemy, and I hope you haven't, but you might have an enemy. If you have an enemy, well, actually, in some way, they're going to be after you more. And if you kill them, you might think, well, God bless. Well, their children are going to come and get you, aren't they? At some point in life. We see it in history all the time. There's a kind of rest when we physically do stuff to our enemies, but it's not the real deal. Far, far from it. But the best way to beat evil is Jesus' way, is to respond in love and forgiveness, because he has come to defeat enmity between people. And so it's been called the violence of grace. And what does the violence of grace mean? Gone over time, but I'm going to read you this last bit because it's, I think I found it really helpful in life. And it's from my favorite play, Les Miserables. So Jean Valjean steals a bit of bread for his family. And he's imprisoned for it for a really long time. It's so unfair how long he's imprisoned for. And his imprisonment makes him really hard and it makes him bad. He kind of becomes a real criminal through it. When he's finally released, a bishop gives him refuge in his house, which is a real risk. And it is a risk because one night, Jean Valjean gets up when they're all asleep and he steals two silver candlesticks. The police that night, they catch him and they drag him back to the bishop. They recognize the candlesticks and they're the bishop and so on. And they say, this man stole from you. And in front of the police, the bishop says to Jean Valjean, my dear brother, I'm glad you took what I suggested. but you forgot to take these other valuables as well. And the police are baffled. And they let him go, and they leave, and the bishop says to Jean Valjean, remember now, you belong now to good. I have bought your soul for God. And when Jean Valjean left the bishop's house, he felt that the pardon of this priest was the hardest assault, the most formidable attack on his heart. See, grace does a wonderful violence. It is a powerful thing to destroy enmity, isn't it? Jean Valjean was called out in that moment. He had to decide, would this act of grace change him? Would he be changed by it? Or would he fall lower still than he already was? And in the story it says he wept long and bitterly. But if you know it, you know he changed from it. Grace gives something very powerful, doesn't it? And this is what Jesus won for us on the cross. The power to defeat enmity and bring us rest from our enemies by breaking the power of evil, showing us how loved we truly are. Rest from our enemies is the gospel. And Esther points us to that. So as you read it this month, read other things around it as well if you can, because it will draw out some wonderful themes that will point you to the gospel and to our Saviour.